This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Why is it that the Seattle Sounders have become such a successful soccer franchise? And I wonder how many of you realize just what a model it has become for the rest of the league. Matt Pence has written about this in a book called The Sound and the Glory. You've been covering the Sounders for how long?
Since 2014.
And I didn't realize until I cracked open your book that the system set up by the Seattle Sounders has become basically a model for the rest of the league. I mean, they are still the most successful team, is that right?
Well, they've been surpassed by a team that almost kind of underlines how important they've been. Atlanta United averaged basically 70,000 fans per game. So
well,
almost
that's
doubling up the
size.
They have just kind of drawn super well, and they're a team that learned a lot from the Sounders. They sent their front office to come and study the Sounders for months, sort of study their business practices, take them back to Atlanta, and you can sort of see how that's continued to grow because of the Sounders' sort of blueprint.
So what was the breakthrough idea that the Sounders had that made them so successful?
They probably targeted the right audience that was very different than what teams were doing at the time. Teams at the time were kind of focusing on the suburban families and sort of the soccer moms and their kids and get them to come out for sort of a play day. Where the Sounders decided to go after sort of the urban crowd, the urban millennials, if you want to call them that, sort of cultivate this fan culture that you see at CenturyLink Field. And it seems so sort of natural now, but at the time, those were kind of revolutionary ideas within the league, and a lot of the teams have copied that now.
So what prevents it then from rising to the level of American football? And I wasn't aware until you just told me now that Atlanta was drawing 70,000. I mean, because that if you could do that on a consistent basis, then you're headed for NFL territory. So what's the secret to doing that?
To overtaking football? I think it's just time. Honestly,
really?
I mean, MLS.
You don't think
that
soccer is, for example, the play-by-play is so much easier to follow in football than soccer. You don't think there are some inherent problems in soccer because it doesn't broadcast as well as football does?
I think it's just different. And I don't know that it's ever going to actually overtake football. Football is just such a cultural in the fabric of U.S. and everything else. But I think that soccer, I think it's just growing. It's on the upswing. I don't know if it will ever overtake it, but I think that people are starting to pick up on the nuances of a little bit. People have shorter attention spans now. The games last less than 2 hours no matter what. It has its own sort of built-in appeals once you get into it. And I think they've done a good job in marketing that side of it. When the World Cup comes back, and Seattle's actually maybe going to be a host city, which would be pretty cool for everybody around here.
That would be a big deal.
Yeah, I think that will sort of be the next step that allows it to continue to kind of take back off and continue to grow.
Explain to me why the schedule is so complicated. I think it's very tough. I'm sure soccer fans get used to it, but for people who are just trying to get into the sport, the same players may play in different leagues and for different teams from time to time.
Yeah, it's just the difference between the national and the international game. It's unique, and I definitely get that. Like soccer definitely has hurdles that it has to overcome. And the complicated schedule, sometimes it's borrowed from Europe, which they could probably stand to do less of to Americanize it a little bit more. For example, like the playoffs used to be two-legged series, and they were always really confusing because you just do aggregate score than have the winner take all.
Right, two games.
And last year, Seattle had this great series against Portland where the lead's going back and forth, but the aggregate
score. It's like one game with a very long intermission.
Yeah, and the scoring's so complicated that my friends in the stadium were texting me, like, who's winning now? We don't totally know. And that's problematic for sure. So this year, they switched it to all single elimination.
Really?
Yeah, to make it a little bit.
So they have changed that.
Well, yeah, so they've been adaptable over time to sort of take on some of those ideas, and I think that will help if they continue to do that over time.
Yeah, I was not convinced that Americans would ever pick up on that idea because we want a result after the game. We don't want to say, to be continued later.
Yeah, so I like the single elimination a lot. It's easy to understand.
So you think it'll continue to grow then?
I think it will, yeah, especially with the World Cup, I think, is a big deal. I think that it will continue to bring in outside investment, too, which is also what soccer needs because they just don't have quite the resources now. But that has changed. And going back to Atlanta, they're owned by Arthur Blank, who also owns the Falcons, and they've poured a bunch of money into that team as well. That's another thing that the Sounders.
Atlanta is a joint ownership between the football team and the soccer team?
Yes, which the Sounders originally shared some business with the Seahawks, too. So that's another sort of blueprint that they've contributed is team up with some of these teams with greater resources, make it actually professional and have money behind it, and it does make a big difference.
Yeah. Are there fantasy soccer leagues?
There are, but they're not particularly popular. Not like fantasy football, for sure.
Can you bet on soccer games?
Not yet, but they're actually making a push for that right now.
There's the key.
Yeah.
Once you put money on the games, then people have to watch and have to go.
Yeah, it makes a bigger difference for sure.
Matt Pence's book is called The Sound and the Glory. Matt, thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on.
Politics and the president's former campaign chairman. Prosecutors had asked for a 25-year sentence for Paul Manafort. A judge gave him 47 months. But another case is coming up next week. We called up Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan for details.
Well, the charges that he's facing in the district include things like money laundering, also different financial crimes as it relates to work he did for Ukrainian oligarchs. But, you know, those who would look at the tax evasion, the offshore money that he had been stashing, things like that would argue he has done damage to the public at large, crimes against American democracy. And so if you want to take that viewpoint, certainly it seems like he's getting a leaner sentence than might be justified. Of course, others would say he's getting on in years. The man has gout. He's now in a wheelchair during this entire trial. He certainly said that this has been incredibly difficult on him and his family, though he never really expressed remorse for any of his crimes. And the judge noted that, saying, you know, I'm surprised that you haven't said you're sorry at any point. This has also raised the specter of maybe he's expecting some kind of pardon, given that the president has consistently commented on the Manafort case throughout this trial, even though he's tried to hold him at a distance, saying he was only campaign chairman for months, and he was for over 100 days. The president has said he thinks he's being treated unfairly. And so some are speculating, well, maybe this means Manafort is expecting a pardon.
Somebody likely not to get a pardon, Michael Cohen.
Well, the president's, the part of this news this week with Michael Cohen is kind of the back and forth on whether he actually sought one or didn't. You know, Michael Cohen said in testimony before Congress last week, he never sought, no, never would, nor never would accept a pardon. Of course, that statement then contradicted by his attorney or one of his members of his legal team, Lanny Davis, who said that there actually had been conversation about it at some point with the president and advisors to the president. All of this swirling really just kind of adds up to these questions as to the credibility of Michael Cohen, who has admitted that he's lied under oath in the past. What it comes down to is anything he alleges needs to be corroborated by investigators. So if they're lies, they're not going to go very far in criminal court unless investigators can back them up with other evidence. But certainly in the court of public opinion, it may hold some sway.
He was brought back this week for a fourth Q&A session with members of Congress, this one behind closed doors. But has anything leaked about where members of Congress are going with their questioning or why he was brought back for this fourth session?
Well, remember, he lied under oath the first time. And so members of Congress have argued it is worth bringing him back to sort of see what they get this time, if there are follow-ups that should have happened that didn't last time with other individuals. In terms of the line of questioning, the political filter has already been put on this. So there's a lot of attacks, particularly questions about this idea of pardons being floated. There are also questions about other payments that Michael Cohen may have made on behalf of then private citizen Donald Trump, now President Trump, to use as hush money to keep other people quiet, to sway the outcome of the election. I mean, there's all sorts of alleged campaign finance violations here, too. But at this point, this is a man who is certainly angry and has professed remorse for the loyalty that he has shown Donald Trump in the past, because right now he's not seeing that loyalty repaid in terms of promise of pardon or reduced sentence.
Yeah, certainly angry enough to now sue the Trump Organization for $1.9 million in fees. Yeah. He said he was denied. That seems like an interesting move for a man who's ready to go to prison.
Well, Michael Cohen says he signed an agreement, I believe it was back in 2017, that the Trump Organization would pay his legal fees. And now that's not happening. And so Michael Cohen is trying to take him to court to pay. Look, he's facing some jail time already. We know that. I believe it's May that he's supposed to go to prison. And he's facing all sorts of different legal challenges. Remember, beyond the special counsel's probe here at the federal level, there are still many lawyers at work back in Manhattan and the Southern District of New York working on some of these alleged financial crimes involving Michael Cohen, his family members, and now President Trump and his family members.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Margaret's guest this Sunday, former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe and former Deputy Secretary of State Bill Burns. Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. Happy International Women's Day, especially to Tom Dagnew, who raised two strong women.
That's right.
And before your co-host, John Curley, asks the inevitable question, International Men's Day is November 19th.
Is that right? Perfect.
I know it's going to happen. So I mentioned International Women's Day because this is very exciting. We have the first female-led superhero movie, Captain Marvel. Hey, it only took 21 movies for a female lead.
Yeah, that's right. It's about time, right? I can hear everyone chanting that right now. Yeah, and they got a great actress to do it. I'm a big fan of Brie Larson. She's an Oscar-winning actress. She was in the great movie called Room. She stars in this latest Marvel comic book movie, Captain Marvel, as a woman who doesn't quite know who she is. And that turns out to be something important. As it turns out, she's eventually Captain Marvel herself, but that doesn't happen without a whole movie's worth of self-reflection first, mixed in, of course, with lots of fistfights, firefights, and intergalactic dogfights. When we first meet Larson's character, she's called Vers. She has a number of names as her identity shifts throughout the film. She's called Vers and is in training as a Kree warrior. The Kree are an alien race in a galactic battle with another alien race, the Skrulls. Since this is an origin story, there's a lot of backstory to get through. Now, Vers ends up chasing Skrulls all the way to Earth, where she crosses paths with a human secret agent and spy, Nick Fury, played by, once again, Samuel L. Jackson. By the way, he has a 9-movie deal with Marvel.
Wow.
He can't quite get a handle on who he's dealing with in this universe.
Excuse me, miss. Why are you dressed for laser tag?
Oh, boy. You guys don't have any clue, do you?
I'm here to stop the shapeshifters that are infiltrating your planet.
So, Skrulls are the bad guys.
They're shapeshifters.
And you're a warrior.
Noble warrior hero.
But what do they want?
That's what I'm here to find out.
So he's kind of scratching his head. Mm-hmm. He's like the stand-in for the audience. Like, okay, who are the Skrulls? Who are you battling?
Yeah, I have to admit, even though I grew up with the Marvel Universe and the DC Universe, I never really followed Captain Marvel,
believe
it or not. I don't know much about her.
Yes. In fact, she's not one of the major characters. In fact, one of the great resources we have in the newsroom, Dyer out there, he knows the whole backstory. And Captain Marvel has gone from being a male to a female and back and forth. So it's a very fluid kind of a character, not in terms of a gender identity, just in terms of who we happen to be dealing with here.
Lest we raise any concerns there now. Yeah. No, we're not.
Get too concerned. Yeah. So anyway, Vers and Fury team up somewhat reluctantly as she battles to save her own skin and track down her past. See, she has no sustained memories, only shards and flashes of random and uncontextualized images. So over the course of the film, these images begin to cohere and she slowly reconstructs her life, all the while, of course, fighting off her enemies in order to stay alive.
Your life began the day it nearly ended. We found you. With no memory, we made you one of us. So you could live longer, stronger, superior. You were reborn.
So, Captain Marvel eventually comes into her own as one of the most powerful superheroes ever, but not before having to revisit and overcome a lifetime of put-downs and dismissals.
Boy, that sounds familiar.
Exactly. Very much a self-empowerment movie for girls. The climactic moment is perhaps a little too reminiscent of the recent Serena Williams Dream Crazier ad, but at least its message is received loud and clear.
I'm kind of done with you telling me what I can do.
Kind of cheer to that line. That line now may not rival I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, but I'm sure it will resonate all the same. Captain Marvel matches the high entertainment standards of Marvel movies in general. Not in the league of, say, Avengers Infinity War or Black Panther, it's nonetheless a thoroughly enjoyable movie.
I'm going to go see this, even though I don't know much about Captain Marvel, because I saw Wonder Woman twice.
Oh, yes.
I kept taking people to it.
Yeah, right.
Because I cried.
Is that right?
Yes. And there's no reason to cry in that movie, but I cried, and it was because seeing the representation of what I know about myself, what I know that I'm strong, I'm capable, this and that. Seeing it, and I'm going to cry right now talking about it. There's just something about having that representation in front of me after a lifetime of having to watch dudes always do the action when I know that I can do it too.
That's exactly what it's tapping into. Now, I don't think it's quite as successful as Wonder Woman and tapping into that because this is a self-discovery movie for her. She doesn't know who she is. And
Wonder Woman is already great.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. She is this goddess warrior. Yeah. This one is coming together, but that doesn't mean that in future movies she's not. In fact, and anybody who goes to any Marvel movies knows, you've got to stick around through the credits. There are two scenes. You stick around to the very, very, very end. But in one of the two scenes, I'm not going to give anything away, she meets up with the Avengers, of course, and they say, who are you? And she says, who are you? Oh, and it's like, oh, God, it all comes together. There's also a very cute cat. I'm not giving anything away, but watch for the cat in this movie as well.
Okay, you'll how many tangs time. For Captain
I'll
Marvel?
I'll give it 3 tangs out of 4.
I love it. And that's not because you're scared to give it less, right?
No, not at all. It's fun. It's just not great. How's that?
Thank you, Tom. Your daily dose of kindness now. We have an inspiring story of one woman's grueling quest to complete 100 marathons in 100 days. But after a major setback, CBS's Nikki Batiste says people around the world rallied behind Mina Guli in a unique way.
The 100 Marathon Challenge was born out of what Guli calls necessity. She is the founder and CEO of Thirst, a nonprofit created to help battle water scarcity around the globe. By the year 2050, the United Nations says as many as 5.7 billion people could be living in these areas without easy access to one of life's most essential resources.
Most people have no idea. So I wanted to run because I wanted to make saving water famous.
Guli began her journey at the New York City Marathon this past November and continued to log her miles in some of the most iconic and remote locations on Earth, winding her way through 6 continents, all spots that have suffered dangerous water shortages. But after 62 days, her body hit the brakes.
What happened on day 62?
I had quite severe pain in my leg. The pain had got so bad that I couldn't walk. My team had to carry me into the car, took me to the hospital, and I was diagnosed with having a fracture in my right femur.
What are you feeling in that moment?
I felt like I'd let everybody down. I felt that I had let down all the people whose stories I wanted to tell. I felt that I had let down the water crisis. I felt I'd let down my planet.
And then you got on your social media.
So actually what happened, I was sitting in the hospital, literally outside the scanning room. The doctors were sitting in front of me and messages started to come through on my phone. And then it was people who I didn't know who offered to donate distance to the campaign. We've had people on all 7 continents, including Antarctica, running for us, running for me, for water.
Strangers from around the world collectively completed nearly 20,000 miles in only 38 days.
Woo! Day 100!
All culminating back in New York City for the 99th and 100th marathons, where her unthinkable mission began.
What has the support from around the world meant to you?
The support has inspired me to keep going. Even when I thought all was lost, it's inspired me to be a better person, to stand up and to be prepared to make a difference. And more importantly, it's shown me that even though each one of us is an individual, together we can make a huge change.
In all, strangers from around the world ran 748 marathons in her name. See, social media can be used for good. 7:48, a happy Friday to you. It's time for our Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. It's Danny O'Neill, who you can hear weekdays at 3 on Danny, Dave, and More. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Colleen. How are you?
I'm good. A full day for you yesterday at spring training. We've got a really promising prospect, Jake Fraley, but also I want to talk about Skipper Scott Service and what you guys learned about him. You learned something new about him. You thought you knew it all.
We did. We learned that in high school, his pursuit of his girlfriend, who is now his wife, included the fact he was in band and played the tuba.
Why was he shy about this?
Well, because he's going to get a great deal of grief from a number of people, including media members. He played the tuba. That's hilarious.
That is a very big talent to be able to play a music instrument.
Yeah, played the tuba, Colleen. Major League manager played the tuba. Now, can you imagine someone, I don't know, renting a tuba and bringing it to him and asking him to play a few notes.
One could
hope. Or perhaps
hope.
Renting a tuba and a tuba player to come and follow him around for a chunk of the day. Like, all of these things are now on the table because we've learned that Scott Servais, who from Wisconsin and familiar with the polka and all of the other kitschy things, is a tuba player.
But he got the girl.
He did. He did. It shows you that in terms of his relentless, we asked how good he was. I think he gave himself, because he used a major league grading scale, mm-hmm. like scouts use a 20 to 80 scale, where 20 is unacceptably low. 80 is the best you can get. Like, someone with an 80 power rating means that's the best possible power prospect you could have. And I think he gave himself a 50. Which is not quite major league caliber, but shows a little bit of promise.
Sure. And I was surprised to see, is he using the word rebuild? I thought we weren't calling it a rebuild.
They're not. I think people have called it a step back. The point that he made to us, which I actually thought was great, is he said, I've heard people say the Mariners aren't going for it. He goes, that's the exact opposite. We are going for it. Instead of trying to have everything go right and us land the second wild card, or basically make the playoffs by getting into position for a one playoff play-in, because the reality is that there's not any sort of projection that you could imagine the Mariners winning their division. He said, we're now looking and saying, okay, we're going to try to win 2 years from now. We're really going to go for it. Instead of trying to eke it in and make the playoffs and say, okay, that's a successful season, we're trying to win a title. We're trying to put ourselves in the best possible chance to win a championship, and that's probably 2 or 3 years from now. And I thought that that was the best way that I've heard it phrased, that anybody who thinks that sort of this step back, or because they do not have the same expectations or hopes for wins that they did a year ago. They're not, and they can say, and that doesn't mean that they're tanking or they're not trying. The club that they've built, the maximum, the conceivable, what you expect them to win is not as great as it was a year ago. And so that sounds like that they've kind of thrown out their hands. But the reality is they put their franchise in a position. They've gone from having one of the worst farm systems in baseball to having a middle to top third. They're somewhere between 15th and 10th in their farm system now, and that's because of the trades they made this offseason.
And one of those trades, Jake Fraley, an outfielder, he's making an impression this spring training.
He is. He's a very interesting prospect. He's quite a hairy fella.
He is. When I saw his age, 23, I thought, wow, he's quite hairy for 23.
Yeah, he is. He's got a little bit of squatch to him, but he's from LSU, college outfielder. He's never played higher than single A. So I can't imagine that he's going to start the season with the big league team. But this team, which has struggled for years to produce outfield prospects, all of a sudden has a number of them. And Jake Fraley's probably had the single most impressive spring, to the point where it's not out of the question that we could see him by the end of the year.
Why wouldn't a standout like him be a shoe-in for a starter?
Because he's not ready for that. A lot of development is about pushing a player to failure, and he's never played higher than single A, and you've got two full rungs of minor league baseball before you get from single A. You've got three or four tiers of single A, and then you've got double A, and then you've got triple A before you get to the major leagues. And when you vault a player up like that, he might not have the tool set developed to compete with what he's going to see at the big league level from big league pitching.
Is that specific to baseball? Because I feel like we see younger players come into football.
Yes, you do see younger players come into football. Yes, it is different for baseball. Mm. And it's part of the development path that you have, where a player, you don't want to throw them into the deep water right away, because if a guy doesn't have the ability to do anything successful at the level he's playing at, you can actually see his skill set regress. You can actually see the frustration set in, and those sort of things, that it's better to have him competing against people that are essentially at his level. And you don't want him just to dominate, because when he improves, then you move him up to the next rung on the ladder. But skipping rungs can create a situation where he's not prepared for what he's going to see. It's possible that we'll see him by the end of the year. It would really surprise me if we see him to start the season.
Understood. Danny, thank you.
You bet. I'll talk to you soon, Colleen.
We start with a pretty serious topic for not only our state, but across the nation, opioid overdose deaths. Now, the number one cause of accidental deaths across the nation. And this is a scary fact. More than 700 opioid-related deaths in our state last year. Two people a day, about, on average, were dying from opioid-related complications. And experts say it's expected to get worse before it gets better. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here to tell us about our state looking at new ways to address the crisis.
Really, and it's all about holistic ways, looking at everything from prevention, treatment, and recovery after treatment to help people get on with their lives. So one big proposal is a request from Governor Inslee. It takes that wide approach, really focusing on treatment and prevention. Democratic Senator Annette Cleveland offering some very sobering details this week on opioids and our kids.
As recently as 2016, 5% of Washington's 8th, 10th, and 12th graders were using painkillers to get high. The number of Washingtonians aged 12 years or older were using prescription opioids non-medically in 2016 was over 259,000 of those young people.
And I'm assuming they're getting them from medicine cabinets predominantly.
Right. Yeah. Right. Parents still having those extra meds laying around that they got at the dentist or whatever. So mm-hmm. that's a big, big focus. We've been doing a lot of work in that in the state on that. And there's more here in this bill. And on the Senate floor yesterday, Annette Cleveland also pointed out to a recent poll of opioid users in our state that found that more than half actually wanted help to stop using them. She says there's also the financial toll.
This epidemic's taking a tremendous toll, financially, certainly. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates the total economic burden of prescription opioid misuse alone here in the U.S. is $78.5 billion a year. I also want to note, Mr. President, the real cost, as we know too well, is the toll that the opioid crisis is taking on our families, on our communities.
So this bill the governor asked for declares opioid use disorder is a disease and should therefore be treated as one.
Same as we treat alcoholism.
Absolutely. Yep. And that makes a big difference when we're talking about the type of care and recovery and treatment you can get. It also focuses on expanding access to medication-assisted treatment, or MAT, with drugs like Suboxone, which is a thing we've been seeing at the county level, and now we're trying to get that statewide. It also requires doctors talk about the risk of opioids, including addiction, with their patients before they give that first initial prescription out. And also, they have to tell them, you don't have to take this. You can say no. And that, again, goes back to that having the extra meds in your medicine cabinet. That's mm-hmm. an effort to keep those extra pills from making it home.
I know more and more people who are choosing to say no after major surgeries, too. They're like, no, I'll stick with Tylenol. I'll stick with ibuprofen. I feel like the message is starting to get out there. And people are actually scared of these drugs now. That the pain, I'll take the pain over a possible addiction. Because for some people, what they don't realize is that these drugs, they are so addictive, it can flip a switch in your brain.
Yes. Absolutely.
That quick.
Anybody. It can be you if you've gone to the dentist, or you can have those extra meds sitting in your cabinet that your kid can get hold of, or your babysitter, or anybody, and it can take one or two times, and you can be that addicted.
I remember being given 13 Oxycontins after I cut a piece of my finger off, which was second to labor as the most painful thing that I have done to myself. And after 13 days of taking them, I felt the effects of withdrawal.
Yes.
And had I been somebody more susceptible to addiction, I might have gone back and asked for more. I might have tried to find more. I can see how slippery that slope is.
And it's just that easy to do it now.
Yeah.
To go find more when you are that person who had that 5-day supply and you're like, you know what? And then again, that risk then turns into, this is why our overdose rates are so high. It's because half of the stuff out there right now is not legit. It's filled with the synthetic fentanyl, which will kill you even faster. So again, this bill will allow make the doctors have to talk to their patients first. Pharmacists would also be able to only partially fill prescriptions, something they are not allowed to do by law right now. This way, if you've got a 20-day supply or 20 pills, you can say, you know what, I don't think I'll need all those. Let's just start with 10. Again, keeping that supply out of the house that you don't need. And then it also strengthens this prescription monitoring program across the state, basically bringing our electronic records into the prescription monitoring to make sure we know where these drugs are going, which shockingly we still don't
know. I've heard a lot of doctors complain about that.
It's a huge
deal. They cannot
track
patients who are going about trying to find different doctors to give them pills who don't know about their past.
You can't bust doctor shoppers still. It's amazing. And another thing, Steve O'Bann, Republican Republican says that a big part of this bill is that it mandates that medicated-assisted treatment, Suboxone, in jails. We've talked about this in Snohomish County. This is expanding that statewide. So that's a huge deal. Quickly, I want to get to the – there was another bill also passed that helps to have people who are coming out of that recovery side get jobs as peer counselors. That's another big push. Mm-hmm. You've been through it. You want to help others go through it, right? They can get work. Gives them a purpose. And another measure in the House passed this week that would have naloxone at all of our high schools that have 2,000 or more students.
And as our legislative expert, just quickly, you know, we talk a lot about bills clearing, bills passing, this and that. Does that necessarily mean this is about to be law?
I would, well, it still has to go through. So right now we're at the midway point. Everything has to be out of its initial house of origin. So the House or Senate bills have to be out of the House or Senate by next week. So then they have to go through the other house, right?
Okay.
I will say these, all of them passed unanimously. There was huge support, big bipartisan effort on the opioid crisis, and I would expect all of these to move forward.
All right. Midway point. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. The South by Southwest Music Festival starts today in Austin, Texas. One of our colleagues from KTTH, Saul Spady, who also happens to be part of the family who started Dick's Drive-In. Not that that's a big deal or anything, but that's why we're talking to him today, because Dick's is at South by Southwest specifically to bring Seattle's music scene to a national audience. Saul, good morning.
Good morning, Colleen. How's it going?
Great. How are things in Texas?
Oh, they're doing great. I just arrived yesterday. I'm getting prepped for the rest of the team to arrive for Dick's Drive-Ins, and it's really exciting. You know, we did our first version of this 2 years ago where we rented out a place on 6th Street, hosted Seattle bands, and actually live-streamed it back to Seattle, and it was a really special experience. And so this year is going to be even bigger, even better. We have an infinity trailer built in, like, into a trailer. There's a full mirrored room that we're going to set up at the house. We're building a stage. There's a local Seattle artist by the name of Madeline Joe who built all of this. Another local artist called Z-Cans actually painted our mural stage, and we're going to have 12 bands come find our house and perform back to Seattle.
Before we talk about the bands, tell me why Dick's started this live stage at South by Southwest.
Because when I visited South by in 2013, I had a lot of friends in the music community, and I realized that, you know, with Austin, Texas being in the middle of the country and really in many ways the middle of the world, people come from all over the world. For example, Washington, D.C.'s government pays for a house to celebrate their culture and art. Brazil pays for a house. Canada pays for a house. And I got down here and I realized Seattle doesn't do that. You know, our big companies, Amazon, Microsoft, create these really big corporate experiences, but no one comes down and supports our music community. And I thought that was pretty sad. I think our music community is really nationally prominent, but maybe it's so hard for us to leave home and to, you know, go to Austin, Texas. We need somebody here to support them.
We always hear about the same Seattle grunge bands, you know, Nirvana, the Omnipresence and that. What are the bands right now making a splash on the national scene that should make Seattle proud?
Well, you know, we have some bigger bands that I'm not hosting at the house. Bands like Dave B is really popping off, another hip-hop guy, Biba. There's actually an artist in town called Saul. It's the same name as me, but it's spelled S-O-L. But for me, what I'm really focused on is actually kind of the Bon Iver, like, big house bands. I've noticed Seattle has a ton of these big bands. They have brass, they have trumpets. You know, it's kind of soul, pop, rock. And two of the bands that are closing out our experience on Friday, one's called La Fonda and the other one's called All-Star Opera. Really amazing. One of the things I love about All-Star Opera is they actually worked with me on the No Child Sleeps Outside campaign and helped raise $10,000 for Mary's Place this January, which is really cool.
And what's the response that you get when you introduce these bands to Austin?
Oh, you know, it's really interesting. The bands kind of are on their own journey, right? So they have to go and find shows at South By. The house that we create is really their oasis, their outpost. We don't have an audience there. Our audience is all digital, right, over Facebook Live, where we let those of your listeners who want to log in and follow Dick's Drive-In can see each of these performances starting on Monday night all the way through Friday. But I'd say the bands are just really grateful. Our music community is incredibly talented. Our artists in our city are amazing, and they deserve to go around the United States. And honestly, they need our help. This is something that we need to step up, and hopefully more people will kind of see what I'm doing and maybe imitate it, because our music community deserves it.
So we can tune in. So for those who might, this might be their first live stream ever, how do they find the Dick's Live Stage and log in to watch these bands?
It's pretty easy. You just go to Dick's Drive-In Facebook page. So it's Dick's Drive-In Restaurants on Facebook, and then you like the page, and then just make sure to stay tuned around, I guess, at 3 p.m. and at 5 p.m. Seattle time. And you log into Facebook, and you'll get the notification that it's being live streamed, and then you just click watch, and then it'll play. The coolest part about it this year is we actually have professional sound team, and we're going to be doing multi-camera shoots, so it'll kind of look a little like TV.
That's Saul Spady from KTTH hosting a showcase of Seattle bands down at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas.